I'll just introduce the speaker, Mr. Adam Buick, on the subject of Marx's attitude to war in his time. Was he right or wrong?
Okay, thanks. Well, I'm going to argue that even in their day, Marx and Engels were wrong in their application of the socialist attitude to war and to wars. So I'm not going to adopt a positive alternative position that they were right in their day, but that conditions have changed since then, making it wrong to apply their position from the 20th century on. Now, what is the point at issue? Well, basically, that we say and have said since 1904 that no war justifies the shedding of a single drop of working class blood. This is because wars arise out of conflicts of interest between capitalist states over markets, sources of raw materials, trade routes, and investment outlets, and over strategic places and points to secure and protect these, which are not issues that concern workers. Now, Marx and Engels did not deny that this was the cause of wars, but still thought that socialists could welcome and even support some wars. I mean, they justified this as being in the interest, what they consider the superior interest, of the revolution, which we'll see what he meant by revolution later. But why is this other than of academic or historical interest? After all, we don't regard Marx and Engels as authority figures or their writings as sacred texts. So why does it, you know, why does it matter today what they might or might not have done or said? In our case, is based on the facts as, you know, we understand them and stands on these, and not on what some great man may have said or done. All the same, Marx and Engels were, like us, socialists, and their own theory of how capitalism works and how history moves is based on ideas that they were the first to formulate into a coherent body of theory. In other words, they shared the same framework of ideas as us and applied the same criteria as we do when deciding what attitude to take towards events. So it's basically this. Do they or do they not favour A, the immediate position of the working class as regards their standard of living, education, safety and health and so on, or B, the wider general interests of the working class in replacing capitalism by socialism? So it's a question of people sharing the same principles coming to different conclusions. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course, but for those who share the principles, it's something more than of mere academic interest. Now, those who argue that Marx and Engels' conclusions were right in their day, but wrong or superseded today, have a point. Conditions in the 19th century were different from those today in one very important respect. I mean, today, capitalist, economic and political forms dominate the world. I mean, this was not the case in the 19th century. I mean, capitalism, it's true, was expanding as an economic system, but had not yet conquered the whole world. In fact, nowhere in the world, not even in Britain, had the capitalist class won full control of political power. I mean, the House of Lords was more or less equal to the House of Commons, and many 19th century prime ministers were drawn from the aristocracy. I mean, they're called Derby, Aberdeen, Salisbury, Rosebery, but I mean, it was the Earl of Derby, the Earl of Aberdeen, and, you know, the Marquess of Salisbury and so on. Now, on the continent, political power was held by a landed aristocracy loyal to a more or less absolutist dynastic ruler, such as in Russia, Austria and Prussia. Now, France had come nearest to establishing the capitalist political form, the ideal capitalist political form of a republic with a government emerging from universal suffrage, bourgeois democracy, if you like. But this didn't turn out to be a stable arrangement. I mean, there was a revolution in 1848 which overthrew the king and established the Second French Republic. But within a few years, France had come to be governed by a dictator, a nephew of Napoleon, who tried to establish a new dynastic rule by proclaiming himself emperor. Now, the ruling classes of Europe at this time, just after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, had a horror of the democratic and republican ideas that have come out of France. And after the defeat of Napoleon in 1815, Britain, France, Austria, Prussia and Russia, which called themselves the powers, formed an alliance to maintain the status quo, which involved stopping the spread of revolutionary ideas from France and suppressing them whenever they appeared. I mean, they did appear. In 1830, when there was a previous king was overthrown, and also in Belgium, which broke away from the Kingdom of Holland. Of course, they made a much more dramatic appearance in 1848 in democratic and nationalist insurrections in France, Poland, Hungary, Italy, and even in Germany and Austria. Now, Marx and Engels had participated in the events of 1848-49, for which they'd written the Communist Manifesto. Now, although this argues the case for communism, as what we call socialism was then called, it saw the way forward as a bourgeois revolution that would be rapidly followed by a proletarian revolution. So it was this two-stage revolution that Marx and Engels meant by revolution, in whose interest they were prepared to welcome or support certain wars. Now, their analysis of mid-19th century events, including wars, was based on the hope of an early such revolution. In fact, they regarded a revolution as the sixth power in Europe against which the other five had got together to oppose and prevent. And I think it's important to understand to what extent the French Revolution was seen as a model by 19th century revolutionaries, whether they were bourgeois democrats or communists, in the same sort of way that the Russian Revolution was seen by revolutionaries in the 20th century. In the 1840s and 50s, the French Revolution had taken place only some 50 to 60 years previously. So, you know, bearing in mind that they've just been celebrating the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landing, the French Revolution was nearer to mid-19th century revolutionaries, including Marx and Engels, than D-Day is to us today. So this is the general background to the main war, which I want to analyse the position that Marx and Engels took. This is the Crimean War, or more accurately, the Russian-Turkish War of 1853 to 56, in which Britain and France intervened on the side of Turkey. Now, the Crimean War is, of course, part of British historical consciousness. And we've all heard of the Charge of the Light Brigade and about Florence Nightingale, and also most people know what a balaclava is, even if they don't know why it's called a balaclava. But in fact, it was a wider war than just in the Crimea. I mean, a British fleet blockaded the Baltic Sea, and there was even some ground skirmishes there. And British and French troops landed in at Varna, in modern-day Bulgaria, even though only as a backup to Turkish forces fighting further north. And there was fighting between Russia and Turkish forces in the Caucasus, in what is now Armenia and Georgia. Now, at the time, Marx was earning a living, it was a rather meagre living, as a correspondent of the New York Daily Tribune. And many of his articles from this period are about this war. I mean, those on the military aspects were, in fact, written by Engels, even though they were submitted by Marx in his name. I mean, Marx himself dealt mainly with the diplomatic aspects. When the articles were collected and edited by his daughter Eleanor and her partner Aveling in 1897, under the title The Eastern Question, where all the articles were attributed to Marx. Now, the Eastern Question was what to do about the Ottoman Empire, the so-called sick man of Europe. At the time, Turkey had sovereignty over large parts of the Balkans, including modern Romania, Bosnia, Macedonia, Albania, and parts of modern Greece and Serbia. Well, the population of most of European Turkey, but by no means all, were Orthodox denomination Christians. The Ottoman Empire was called the sick man of Europe because it wasn't able to control these areas, and their rule was seen as being in danger of collapse. Now, the five powers, including Russia, were in accordance with their policy of maintaining the status quo. They were against the breakup of the Turkish Empire in Europe, but they still vied with each other to influence and even control, in their own interest, the Sultan and his government in Constantinople. in 1853, Russia made a move to win such control by demanding to be the protector of Orthodox Christians in the Ottoman Empire, which was giving them an important say in how the empire was governed. I mean, the Sultan refused, and to intimidate him, in July, Russia moved troops into what was then called the Principalities, which is essentially modern-day Moldavia and Romania, which were autonomous regions under Turkish sovereignty. Various diplomatic moves, described in great detail by Marx, were made to try to resolve the situation, but to no avail. In October, Turkey declared war on Russia. Now, of course, the real cause of the war wasn't the position of Orthodox the Ottoman Empire's Orthodox Christian subjects, or about which particular Christian sect should keep the keys or sweep the floor in some church in Jerusalem or Bethlehem, but it was about economic interests. Now, Engels wrote a brilliant article for Marx that was published in the New York Daily Tribune on the 12th of April, 1853, entitled "The Real Issue in Turkey." That's been left on the seats for people to have a look at. Now, it's the sort of thing you could read in the Socialist Standard, analysing the economic causes at stake, which were trade routes and strategic points to control and protect them. Now, as you'll see, Engels says that the real issues were who will control the mouth of the Danube River, because at this time the main means of inland transport was water, and who will control the overland route to India, because I mean, the Suez Canal hadn't been opened or didn't exist at this time. But I want to draw your attention to the final paragraph, which I think is the key to explaining the position of Marx and Engels. In fact, it's the last sentence part of the final paragraph. When Engels wrote, "The maintenance of Turkish independence, or in case of a possible dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, the arrest of the Russian scheme of annexation, is a matter of the highest moment. In this instance, the interests of the revolutionary democracy and of England go hand in hand. Neither can permit the Tsar to make Constantinople one of his capitals, and we shall find that, when driven to the wall, the one will resist him as determinately as the other." Now, I would have thought this is clear enough. Russian expansionism has to be stopped. But Hal Draper, who's a respected commentator on Marx's writings, has claimed, "No one has ever documented a word of political support to the alliance of Western powers against Russia in the Crimean War." Now, it's true that Engels' article was written in April 1853, when there was, at that time, no war. I mean, Russia didn't occupy the principalities till July, and Turkey didn't declare war till October. In fact, France and Britain didn't declare war till March 1854. And I can't see any other interpretation that could be put on what Marx wrote in Marx's name, that was in fact published as an unsigned leading article, than support for any action to stop Russian expansionism. Now, it's true that Marx and Engels did not give any political support to the British and French governments, but was highly critical of them. But if you read the articles, and I've read them all, some of them for the first time, but if you read these articles, their main criticism of Britain and France was that they were not opposed enough to Russia, that they were not prosecuting the war with enough seriousness or determination, and that Britain in particular was carrying out diplomatic manoeuvres to try to get Russia off the hook. But in fact, the British cabinet contained Russian agents, these are Marx's own words, such as he alleged, Aberdeen, the Prime Minister, and his particular bugbear, Lord Palmerston. And it's clear, in the description of the battles, it's clear that their sympathies are with the Turkish side. I mean, the Turks fight courageously against the Russians, while a Russian naval victory is described as a cowardly attack on a weaker force. I mean, Marx and Engels clearly wanted Russia to be defeated. Now, Engels' concluding paragraph in this article is a continuation of what he and Marx and other German revolutionaries had been advocating in 1848-49, when Marx was the editor of the Neue Rheinische Zeitung in Cologne, which incidentally was a bourgeois democratic, not a socialist paper. This paper was advocating continuously revolutionary war against Russia. Now, as Engels must have explained 35 years later in 1884 in an article in a Swiss socialist newspaper. Incidentally, this is one of the articles which has been taken off the Marxist Internet Archive because of their copyright dispute with Lawrence Wissop. But fortunately, I bought a copy of the selected works of Marx and Engels in the 1960s for 7 and 6 pence. And so I can read it here. This is what Engels wrote about the foreign policy of the German revolutionaries in 1848-49. Our foreign policy was simple: to come out on behalf of every revolutionary people and to call for a general war of revolutionary Europe against the mighty bulwark of European reaction, Russia. If one succeeded in getting Germany to make war on Russia, it was all up with the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns, and the revolution would triumph along the whole line. I mean, this was never going to happen, but I mean, the revolutionary democratic movement in Germany didn't even win. But it's a good illustration, I think, of how 19th century revolutionaries, or mid-19th century revolutionaries, were influenced by the model of the French Revolution, because this is what happened in 1792 when the French revolutionaries decided to wage a revolutionary war against reactionary Europe. Now, before going on to consider whether or not the furtherance of the revolution was a valid or realistic standard by which to decide whether or not to support a war, I should finish describing what happened in the Crimean War and its outcome. As I said, Britain and France had declared war on Russia in March 1854, but it wasn't until September that they invaded the Crimea with the aim of capturing and destroying the Russian naval base of Sebastopol. Now, when this was achieved a year later, in September 1855, Russia had effectively lost the war. Under the Treaty of Paris, which ended the war, Russia had to cede a piece of land on the left bank of the Danube, which would deprive it of control over its mouth, and both Russian and Turkish warships were banned from the Black Sea. In short, Russian expansionism had been checked. What Engels wrote in that article had come to pass. Russia no longer could control the mouth of the Danube and couldn't threaten the overland route to India. Now, subsequently, there were wars between the powers. France versus Austria in 1859, Prussia versus Austria in 1866, and then, well, this is sounding a bit like the World Cup, the winners, Prussia versus France in 1871. Now, in all these wars, Marx and Engels applied the same criteria as to whether they or the outcome would favour the cause of revolution. I mean, it has to be said, though, that for Marx, it was whether or not this would favour Russia. Now, in 1940, which was the first conference after the Second World War broke out, the Socialist Party adopted a statement on the party's attitude to war. And it began: being an organisation that exists for the purpose of achieving socialism, the SPGB is bound to examine any proposed course of action, including war, in relation to the following considerations. One, has the proposed action the purpose of achieving socialism, and will it achieve this result? Two, has the proposed action the purpose of safeguarding democracy, and will it have this result? Three, has the proposed action the purpose of achieving an improvement in the conditions of the workers, and will it have this result? All these considerations must, of course, be judged in relation to the consequences, both direct and indirect, immediate and remote. Now, these three criteria: is the aim and the likely outcome to be socialism? Is the aim and likely outcome to be political democracy? Is the aim and likely outcome to be an improvement in workers' living standards? I think they're good criteria by which to decide an attitude to war. Now, Marx and Engels, being active in the different conditions of the 19th century, were in effect adding another: would war, or a particular war, further the continuation of the anti-feudal revolutionary wave that had been unleashed by the French Revolution? Now, only one of the 19th century wars, that's the Franco-Austrian War of 1859, which is also known as the Second War of Italian Independence, might have fitted into this category as a name. But ironically, Marx was somewhat lukewarm about supporting it, as he suspected Louis Napoleon was playing Russia's game by weakening Austria, from which Russia would get an advantage. In fact, Marx obstinately stuck to his view that anything that weakened Russia would help the progress and consolidation of capitalist forms. Well, there were, in fact, no wars between the Western powers and Russia after 1853-55. I mean, there was another Russian-Turkish war in 1877-8, in which Marx took the same position towards this as he had during the Crimean War. I mean, he favoured the defeat of Russia. I mean, this, incidentally, was the event that brought William Morris into politics before he was a socialist, as a radical liberal and treasurer of the Eastern Question Association, which wanted the opposite outcome, the defeat of Turkey because of what Gladstone called the Bulgarian atrocities. Now, the additional criteria which socialists might have applied in the 19th century could also be expressed in this way. Has the proposed action the aim of furthering capitalism at the expense of feudalism and so preparing the way for socialism? And will it achieve this? Now, some wars undoubtedly did help capitalism triumph over feudalism and capitalism to progress towards becoming the dominant world system. But the 1940 Socialist Party statement, which I read, also says this, or says it's the final part of it, which I quoted. All these considerations must, of course, be judged in relation to the consequences, both direct and indirect, immediate and more remote. Now, one immediate effect of any war is the effect on the soldiers doing the killing and dying and on the civilian population affected. Now, it's true that war wasn't regarded with the same sort of horror then as it is today, and so wasn't emphasised as much as we do today as one of the evils of capitalism. But he still wouldn't want to be in an area affected by the fighting or troop movements, since at the time armies lived partly off the land by requisitioning, in other words, plundering supplies from the local population. And although many of the soldiers would have been of peasant rather than working class origin, they were killing and dying in a cause that was not theirs. Now, another more remote and ultimately disastrous consequence was that wars encourage nationalism. I think this is the most serious objection to the attitude that Marx and Engels took up with regard to war and wars in the 19th century. Now, Marx knew perfectly well that one of the consequences of war was to encourage nationalism. As in one of his articles for the New York Daily Tribune, this was in April 1855, he describes the situation in a typical English village where one of the agricultural labourers would have gone off as a soldier and he would come back as a hero. And this is what he wrote. Among these people, the war enthusiasm is as strong as ever. There's not a village where is not to be found some new beer shop with the sign, "The Heroes of the Alma," or some such motto, and where there are not, in almost every house, wonderful prints of Alma, Inkerman, the Charge of Balaclava, portraits of Lord Raglan and others to adorn the walls. Now, in the part of South Wales that I come from, there's actually a town called Sebastopol, and it was founded at this time. So, I mean, that's another example of nationalist fear. As a matter of fact, just up the road, there's another town called Nelson. But in those days, of course, this wasn't a coal mining area. It was ironworks. And, of course, the title of the town was chosen by the local ironmaster, not by the people who were living there. But in the same article, Marx seems to have some illusions about the industrial working population. He says that both British and French proletarians are filled with an honourable national spirit, though they're more or less free from the antiquated national prejudices common in both countries in the peasantry. I think it's true, it might well be true, that the industrial workers were less jingoistic than some other sections of the population. But this would have been partly because they shared some of the views of their liberal employers, such as the general anti-war position adopted by the political representative of the Manchester Free Trade School, Richard Cobden and John Bright, who Marx repeatedly criticises in his articles because they oppose Britain going to war with Russia. I don't know if he actually used the term, but he would regard them, I think, as peacemongers. Marx also regularly accused the French dictator, Louis Bonaparte, of engaging in wars in order to try to bolster popular support for his regime, which shows again that he knew nationalism grew in a country engaged in a war. I mean, it's happening now in Britain, isn't it? I mean, is it tomorrow or the following Sunday that's Armed Forces Day? That never used to exist, but because British soldiers are fighting, this sort of nationalism is spreading and being encouraged. Now, of course, wars do encourage nationalism in the warring countries, but of course, national sentiment has already to have some implantation for a government to be able to exploit it or to use it to win support for a war. But it does encourage and reinforce nationalism and the view that a nation is more important than class. And after the war, it just cannot be turned off. For instance, I think a large number of the people who voted UKIP in the recent elections are still influenced by war films with Germany as the enemy. Anyway, we know what happened. When the First World War broke out, most workers enthusiastically rallied to support their governments. I mean, nationalist feeling proved stronger than class consciousness and proletarian internationalism. I mean, the Second International of Social Democratic Parties, which was committed on paper to proletarian internationalism, collapsed. Okay, so Marx and Engels were wrong even in their day. But what should socialists at the time have done instead? Now, I'd suggest that that's an academic question. Even so, I think that socialists of that time should have opposed nationalism more consistently. After all, slogans such as "all men are brothers" and "workers of all lands unite" were already in circulation. There was even a group in the International Working Men's Association, the First International, these are some French workerists, who did criticise nationalism and objected to Marx arguing that one of the aims of the First International was to eliminate Russian influence in Europe. I mean, they did this on the grounds that this was not a working class issue. Now, Marx opposed them because he regarded Polish nationalism as a progressive force, since if an independent Poland was established, this would be a buffer between Russia and the rest of Europe. But typically, incidentally, in his private correspondence, he called them allies of Russia. I'm afraid that the accusation that Hal Draper attempts to deny that Marx had an anti-Russian obsession, and it sometimes clouded his judgment, I don't think it can be refuted. But on one point, Marx and Engels were proved right. Now, after Marx's death in 1883, the five powers, which at the beginning of the century had tried to maintain the status quo in Europe, they fell out with each other and formed themselves into two rival blocs, Britain, France and Russia, against Germany and Austria, which was, of course, the lineup in the First World War. Now, where Engels in particular was right was his view that a general European war would lead to the fall of the three remaining dynastic regimes of Prussia, Austria and Russia. I mean, this was indeed one of the results of the First World War. I mean, these regimes fell, as did the Ottoman Empire, when they were replaced by independent states, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia. But the cause of democracy, let alone socialism, was not favoured by this development. I mean, but petty nationalism and ethnic cleansing were, however. We all know what happened in Russia, where the Bolsheviks established a state capitalist dictatorship, which lasted for over 70 years. But the outcome of the First World War did mark the final triumph of capitalism as the dominant world system, so disposing of all arguments about whether or not socialists should support the development of capitalism so as to provide the material basis for socialism. I mean, this now clearly and undoubtedly existed, in fact, it probably existed for already that time, for the previous 40 or so years. So this put socialism at the top of the agenda. So from then on, the task of socialists has been to call and work for the immediate establishment of socialism without getting sidetracked into supporting wars or anything else. Okay, thanks.